everybody, psychics, herbalists, just anything I could think of to avoid the reality of the situation. And so within a very short period of time, maybe a year and a half or so, some other tragic events happened that were beyond my control. And literally my life just unwound. And I was a very ambitious woman, and so I found it very disconcerting. And it took a few years for it to just completely undo in all categories, you know, financial, health, loss of loved ones, you know, death. I mean, I actually ended up referring to it as my Job experience. And once I got my humor back, we say that God, you know, visited a plague upon my house. And I had to put myself back together. And so I became extremely interested in the midlife process. Now, not everybody has to do that. You know, not everybody has that sort of thing happen to them. But now, because of that, you know, it informs everything I do. And most of my clients, not all of them, but most of my clients are between the ages of about probably 50 and 60 years old. And many of them come to me for many, many different reasons. And sometimes it is something that drastic, and they're in deep grief, or they're stuck in grief, or something like that. They can't move forward in life. Other times the identity is challenged by job loss. One of the things I do, what I call my day job, is that I work internationally and cross-culturally with executives that are transitioning out of multinational corporations. And so from that experience, I've learned how to really coach the individual. And then my union experience led me into something called depth coaching. And so I take all of the theory, all the things I know about coaching, and then what I know, you know, personally, what it takes to move forward in life when you've had tragedy or you're just stuck. Some people just show up because they have everything they want, but because they're secular, you know, they don't really have, let's say, a religion or a spiritual life to fall back on. They're just sort of hapless, if you will, you know, and they're looking for more. And so people show up for all sorts of reasons into my office. But basically what I see happening is that the identity has been challenged. There's been some major loss, and the identity is challenged, and so they wind up with me for a while, or for a long while.
What's the average time for... This is not a curing. I don't call this a curing situation.
Yeah.
It's a transitional situation in a positive sense. Right.
Yeah, I support them psychologically, emotionally, and spiritually. I mean, one of the reasons I left a purely Freudian psychological frame of reference and went toward depth psychology, which really is the what Jung called his work was depth psychology, was because it includes spirit. And I thought I would mention that since, you know, this is going global for spirit. And so I can't talk to other human beings without beginning to, you know, find out, you know, what's going on, you know, with them in that realm. And people have, you know, all sorts of different ways of experiencing that. And I also, you know, teach mindfulness meditation techniques and in the line of Dr. John Kabat-Zinn. And so I do that. And sometimes people are introduced into their spirit, if you will, or developing and, you know, beginning to develop that aspect of their humanity through tragedy, you know, or through just something as simple as mindfulness meditation, or beginning to talk with someone like myself in a very deep way about what's very, very personally, you know, of personal value to them. You know, not what I say. I'm not a spiritual teacher. I leave that to the spiritual teachers and the metaphysicians, but we do bring that topic in along with, you know, whatever is going on with them.
Dance, there's a very thin line there. There's a very thin line between what you're calling metaphysical and spiritual teachers and what you do. You almost can't do the work that you're doing on just an intellectual level. You have to touch spirit.
Oh, I have to. But I never want to stop or interfere with someone's process, you know, and I don't talk too much about my own, you know, personal spiritual life. It's extremely sacred to me, and it's something I've pursued since I'm 7 years old. And so when someone is looking, you know, toward that, we use things, I use words like intuition. You know, Jung used the word intuition. He said that the human personality basically had four functions, and it was two irrational functions. And by irrational, we do not mean crazy or anything like that. We mean intuition and then senses. You know, so we gather info through our intuition or our divine intuition. Some people think of it that way. And then through our senses. And then we categorize in our thinking function. And then we give value through our feeling function. And so I'm always looking at people this way. And then plus, you know how empathic I am. I mean, personally, you know that. And
mm-hmm.
so I'm reading the human being in all sorts of ways. But I'm not going to say, well, this is how you should believe about, you know, your religious leanings or your spiritual ideas or anything like that. I will not, you know, talk about that with someone unless really, really, really pressed. And then, and very, very, very cautiously, because I don't want to interfere with that process with anyone. I want to support it, Elaine. There's a big difference.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I can, but like I said, it's a thin line, and I admire you for how you categorize that and how you go into the many different directions. And I would imagine that every single person that calls you or walks into your office, you have to handle all of those accordingly. You can't say this is how we're going to do. I would imagine that you can't say this is a program and everybody has to follow that. And the spiritual base and your empathic base is so crucial to what you're doing. I'm just saying, I really admire how you can plug that in and make it work without being an interference.
Well, one of the things
in
I do, I don't know how much you've been on my site, but I use the term authentic self,
mm-hmm.
and I use it because I do work cross culturally. I mean, I work with Buddhists and Jews, and numerous, I mean, there's over 22,000 sects in Christianity alone, you know. So who am I to tell somebody, you know, how to believe? I'm just not going to do it. But if you start talking with people about their authentic self or, you know, and I'm going to give you some other names for that, you know, like some people call it soul, some people call it higher self, true self. The Hindi, call it Atman, you know. In the Urantia book, are you familiar with that, the Urantia
mm-hmm.
book? Yeah, they call it the Father Jester.
Years ago.
It can be inner voice, Buddha nature. You know, people call it all sorts of different things. And so, what I try to do is really consider my audience, and I tell all my clients to do that too. You know, when you're talking and communicating with somebody, you know, we're taking a journey like we are right now, and so we have to, you know, learn how to listen in a way that's called, you know, active listening, where we're really listening instead of competitively listening, you know, waiting for someone to shut up so we can give our opinion. And so learning how to do this work and then the continual training, because I'm always, you know, I'm in my training analyst office at least a few times a month. And so, you know, we're looking at people's dreams and we're looking at people's emotions and their psychology and their personality and things of this sort. And then I'm acting as one human to another because I'm not sitting there telling people theory. You know, no one wants to hear that when they're grieving over the loss of a loved one or, you know, or a career or health, you know, or whatever it is that brings someone in front of me. You know?
I like what you said in your, excuse me, in your essay. You called the authentic self is that part of you that mediates between your ego's desires and yourself or soul, if you will. It is who you were before your early experiences of parents, teachers, and society molded you into who you are today. I love that term, that those sentences.
Thank you. I have this exercise, you know, when people first come, if they engage in this process with you, one of the first thing we do is start exploring their personal values. And I'm sort of like the devil's advocate in you, if you will. You know, I'm the one that's going to challenge you and ask very pointed questions around what you value. And are you in alignment with your personal values? Because when you're over 50, I mean, excuse me, you know, we need to be in alignment, you know, with who we truly are. And when we are in authentic alignment with what Jung called the self, which is the same, you know, the same thing as what some people would call soul or God, you know, then the ego kind of takes a back seat. But sometimes we get whipped around. You know, in my world, theoretically speaking, the ego is a seat of consciousness. And that's the most important thing, is consciousness, you know, because the unconscious is a very, you know, you want to go there very, very carefully, you know, very judiciously, and only, you know, if you have the capacity to do that. So you can be a very spiritual person and very involved in spirit and not very in touch with unconscious contents of your own personal conscious. Some people don't even believe that, you know, that there is such a thing as a personal unconscious, much less a collective unconscious or objective psyche is what he later, you know, called it. And so that's what we call it now, objective psyche. I think that some people would call it Akashic Records. You know, the objective psyche is the kind of the storehouse, if you will, of all things human, everything that's ever happened. And Jung believed that we could tap into that individually, that we could tap it. I do, too. In fact, I know we can because I do that.
Excuse me tonight, public and Nance. There seems to be something trying to settle in my throat, and I apologize for that. You'll hear me probably cough periodically throughout the evening. I don't mean to be offensive. I love what you're doing with letting the public, giving the public something else to think about lining up the metaphysical / spiritual terminology for versus, if I may use that word, a more mainstream psychological terminology like the Akashic Records. Some people call them Akashic, some call them Akashic Records, mm-hmm. where all of the information is supposed to have been stored for past, present, and future for that particular spirit. It's like a big library of information, if you mm-hmm. will. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens with our soul, with our subconscious, is what you're saying, right?
Not subconscious. That's a Freudian term.
Okay. See, there's another term we can look at, another methodology.
No, I'm already. In fact, we really probably shouldn't talk about that so much because then I'll get into jargon and things like that. No, the collective, I will define this to the best of my ability, the collective unconscious or the objective psyche, okay, my current understanding, let's put it that way first because one of the things I think one must do when we start to talk about things like this is really possess open-mindedness and a humble heart. You know, so it is the collective storehouse, if you will. It's where you will find the archetypes, you know, if you will. It's the storehouse of all things human. You know, and so, but to be able to begin to learn how to, you know, access that takes great maturity and self-awareness, and usually some sort of guidance. I mean, we do it in a variety of ways. And in my world, you know, if someone's engaged in this with me, not everyone is engaged in analytical work with me, we start talking about dream analysis. And so the way that we begin to approach that, you know, from the point of view of psyche, from the point of view of psychology, because that's the only way I'm willing to talk about it, is that we start with, you know, the dream. What's going on in the dream life, you know, what's going on in the emotional life, what's going on in the fantasy life, because the unconscious, the personal unconscious speaks to us through the dreams, you know, through bodily symptoms, you know, tones, moods, you know, feeling states, things of this sort. And if we learn how to be with that in a highly creative way, then we start getting all sorts of information about ourselves. Some of which we may like, you know, because we'll begin to tap into maybe really positive aspects of ourselves that we've pushed underground for some reason or another. And we also come in contact with aspects of ourselves that maybe don't quite line up with our ego ideals or, you know, the stories we tell ourselves about who we think we are, much less who we think others are or, you know, our world. Excuse me. Am I making sense?
You're making a lot of sense to me. I'm hearing another version of what I work with.
Mhm.
In my world.
Mm-hmm.
I was saying a while ago there's such a thin line. And I'm so appreciative of the work that you've done on what I would have to say the brain level as well as tapped into the spiritual level and how you've combined the two. I suspect that what you do, the practice that you have, is a unique practice.
I think so. And self-compass, the reason the website has the name self-compass is because of exactly what we're talking about. My friend Ray Ben Erskine's in Houston, Texas. He and I were sitting around one day about 6 or 7 years ago, and he's a writer, and we're always kind of engaged in this highly creative, active imagination sort of deal. And we came up with this. And it's sort of like, you know, my version of the North Star, if you will. And I'm a big proponent of really becoming, of relying on your own internal sensibilities. The world's kind of nutty. And we need true individuals. And so I feel real called to do this, like I'm sure you do too, Elaine. Why else would we do it? We're definitely not going to get wealthy, you know. So
I know very few wealthy psychics.
What did you say?
And I know very few wealthy psychics, that's for sure.
And I know very few wealthy counselors.
Goodness. One of the things that you also say about authentic self-awareness, and I like that term, authentic self-awareness, fundamentally, it is about authentic self-awareness and not about religion or God. Even though many come to this deeper experience of authenticity through a religion, a spiritual teacher, or those disciplines that emphasize self-mastery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I like that.
That's my current understanding. Yeah, definitely.
A lot of soul searching goes into it to the work that you do, not just for your client, but for you, because I would think with every single client that you have, you become a person of more questions than you have answers, probably. But you also have, with everybody that walks in and out of your door, you have a higher awareness and a deeper awareness of who you are as an individual and your own authentic self that you can,
well,
in turn...
Well, if it's a good day, I do. If it's a bad day, I don't. I mean, you know, there is, you know, first and foremost, I'm highly trained, and I'm an empiricist, and I like to say that now, just like Jung did, you know, and all this other stuff, too. So it's not, you know, this or that. It's this and that. And so on a good day, it does bring more questions. In fact, I tell my clients, just like, I can't remember which mystic poet, whether it was Rumi or Rilke, they said the questions are more important than the answers. And so I call them VIQs, very important questions. And one of the very first questions I ask someone once they're past the grief process, if they're in grief, okay, because we have to get that aside. We have to get the emotions under control, you know, before we can even start even thinking about anything like this. And so is that the very first question I ask someone is, what do you have to unlearn so that you can master the future you want to envision for yourself? What do you have to unlearn? You know, or what fears, another favorite question of mine is, what fears do you have to face, you know, so that you can respond? And I like to make acronyms out of things so people can remember them. So to me, fear is face everything and then respond. And, of course, the facing everything is the very difficult, challenging part. Yeah. Especially if your life does not turn out to be exactly what you thought it was going to be. You know, when we're older. I mean, we're living on borrowed time. Jung says that, you know, he says it in a way that moderns don't like to hear it. He says the first half of life is about learning how to live. The second half is about learning how to die. And what I usually say is the second half is learning about letting go, because no one wants to hear that. And I have to begin to broach that subject also very, very gingerly, depending upon, you know, the person. Each person has their own beliefs about that, or they don't think about it, or they don't want to accept their own mortality. So one of the things that also begins to happen, you know, after 50 is that we have to confront our own mortality. And the sooner we do it, I told my friend Sylvia in Hot Springs the other day, you know, we can cooperate with this, you know, so that we can do it with grace and dignity. Or like the Dalai Lama, you know, he says we should try to die a conscious death. You know, or we can go kicking and screaming. You know, it's our choice. So I like to bring in, you know, like I said, to make it highly creative. And so then we start looking at ways to tap in to that emotional realm, you know, in the feeling realm, so people can really get in touch with what's really important to them. So things like active imagination, dream work, journaling, any kind of artistic endeavor, music. You know, I like to write, as you well know. I write poems, I write all kinds of things, prose, all kinds of things, you know, to give expression to my innermost self, and I encourage my clients to do the same thing.
What was it that, it's a joke of some sort, and I'm horrible about jokes, but the punchline basically is, somebody, I can't remember where I read it, this person wants to come sliding up to the pearly gate saying, what a ride.
Well, I like that. I prefer the card myself, that little old lady that there's a series of cards, and she says, I want to come in the world, you know, I'll go out the world just like I came in, naked with a doctor slapping me on my butt, you know. whatever floats your boat or peels your banana or whatever, you know, because, you know, none of us are getting out of here alive. And so I don't like to take this stuff very, very seriously unless, of course, I'm in front of somebody that's having trouble with it. And I've had a lot of experience with this, unfortunately. You know, I have a huge clan. I'm from the Gulf South. I am from New Orleans, folks. And so, you know, we've experienced all kinds of loss. You know, my family and I, we're huge, huge clan, racially mixed, ethnically mixed, and so, you know, it's just a very unique, you know, familial background, you know, that I have, and so there's been a lot of loss there, you know, very, you know, personal loss, and so it's something I've been having to, you know, become comfortable with. So if I sound glib about it, I'm really not, you know. It's a very, very, you know, sacred passage, you know, transition, very sacred transition, transitional part of life, you know, and a mysterious one. I prefer to think of it as a mystery.
Think of as?
Hmm?
You prefer to think of as what? I
prefer to think of it as a mystery that we really kind of don't quite know. I don't want to go a thinker on it, you know. I don't want to say, well, this is what it is. I prefer to think of it as a mystery, and then we deal with our emotions and our beliefs, you know, and our unconscious processes around the mystery, you know, as we make our way through the second half of life. And unless you plan on being, you know, living to 100, 50 plus is past, you know, midlife, but the midlife process can start as early as the late 20s. That's some of the literature shows that people can go into it as early as their early 20s. So we have to be careful about categorizing ourselves also and others, you know, whether or not we're at midlife. It's just
what constitutes a crisis, a midlife crisis?
I think, a midlife crisis, for me, it was brought on by trauma, you know, and others, it's some people refer to it as the dark night of the soul, you know, and it is when the ego, you just lose your footing. Nothing's working, and, you know, and it's usually trauma. It's something brings it on, you know, an illness, you know, diagnoses, you know, of illness, having to confront your own mortality, loss of a loved one, something like that. And so this just really shakes our identity because we like to think that we really know ourselves, you know, and that we know everything and we have a handle on, life. I mean, that's just Western mind, you know, and it's just the way it is. In fact, on my site, under my name, where I'm trying to give people an idea of who I am, you know, I talk about this and that having, you know, analytical thinking, which is something I love it, you know, the ability to think analytically. If we don't have self-knowledge, it's dangerous. But if we have it, if we get into this thing called hubris or inflated pride, you know, if we really think we know everything, and eventually we call it ego inflation, and it can be positive or negatively charged. So you can be in a negative inflation and be very, you know, stuck in a grief process, or you can be, you know, positively inflated, like I was before I had my, you know, my Job experience, my personal water load. I was very inflated. I didn't know I was inflated because it's unconscious. We don't really know we are. Unless, of course, you're engaged in some sort of discipline where someone calls you on it, like the master-student relationship, you know, the guru relationship, or in my case, the training analyst. And then also I have another mentor, Dr. Manenberg. I've got to give his book a plug. Dr. Manenberg is a local physician here, and he's had many experiences. And he recently published a book called Caduceus, A Physician's Quest for Healing. And if you Google his name on the Internet, it's Manenberg, you'll find his book. In fact, he's written several books. And
I wrote his last name for us.
Manenberg. I wrote
B-E-R-G.
Manenberg. Mm-hmm. Manenberg. And he wrote that, and I wrote the preface to it. And it's about the, you know, impact of psyche on matter. And so one of the things we have to, if you're really interested in that sort of thing, we have to be able to find a way to put our ego ideals, our images of how we see ourselves and how we see our world aside. It's not that we don't use them. I mean, because in the West we need, you know, good, strong egos, you know, that are well integrated so that we know, you know, our weaknesses and our strengths. And then we step back from that. That's authenticity. I mean, when you're in authenticity, it's not that you're in some perfected state. That, I would say, is either hubris, you know, or some sort of inflation, or maybe the Buddhists call it spiritual materialism, you know, when the ego usurps the spiritual realm. And from my point of view, that's very dangerous, a very dangerous place to be. You know, so at least it was for me, and it is for some of my clients. And so we have to be careful, I think, when we start exploring those sorts of things.
That reminds me of what your aunt said in your essay, the last paragraph, you're talking about how people handle things.
Mm-hmm.
You said that your 80-year-old auntie still dances and swims and participates in local civics groups and sings in the choir, so on and so forth. And you ask her about the passing of loved ones and how she handles it. And she said, well, I just put it to the back of my mind and leave it there until I'm able to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Some people would say that that's not being real. Some people would say that that's just avoiding things. But she characterizes it by saying, until I'm able to deal with it.
Exactly.
When do you know when to deal with it? When do we, as human beings on our levels, what questions should we be asking ourselves about handling a trauma, whether we're 20, when we usually don't have enough common sense to know we've got
that's
a trauma?
That's a good question. You know, that's a good question.
To
if we
the 80-year-old.
Hmm?
To the 80-year-old.
Well,
lived a lot of life, and
she's able to put it behind her because she's lived a lot of life. She's 80 years old.
Yeah.
She's wise. She lives in that Sophia wisdom. I mean, she's not, you know, scrapping, you know, for a chicken bone or, you know, trying to prove herself in any way anymore. You know, she's a wise woman. When we start talking about trauma, though, like, gosh, you know, all the people that I've had, you know, had to deal with in my family, my friends, you know, that experienced trauma, myself included. I wasn't in New Orleans when Katrina didn't bother New Orleans that much. It was the flood, and we won't get into that because it's a political discussion, and I'll get angry. But anyway, you know,
we'll just pass right
trauma,
over that one.
when you're in that kind of trauma, one of the things I noticed, in fact, what it brought, have you ever heard of Maslow's hierarchy of needs?
Oh, yeah.
And, well, you know, we usually assume that most people have their basic needs, survival needs, met. Well, in an event like that, people I knew and loved, you know, did not have basic survival needs met. And so then when you're in something like that, I mean, you're just trying to survive. And we do it in all sorts of ways. We enter, you know, it, depending upon the personality and things of that sort, people enter that in all sorts of ways. My auntie in New Orleans, I was talking with her the other day, and I've known that she has been in denial ever since she was evacuated, you know, from New Orleans. I've known that. I can tell it, you know, in her voice. I know her, you know, those sorts of things. And now, finally, she is admitting to me is she's just now beginning to fully experience the emotions, the emotional, you know, brunt of that experience. So when we suffer loss, we enter a grief phase. And depending upon the nature of the loss, it, you know, really depends upon, you know, what's going on. And again, the personality. And so we can enter in any emotion, anger, denial, numbness, and I consider being numb, you know, an emotional state, a negative emotional state, if you will, and not negative as in bad, but I don't know how to say it, kind of a non-emotional state, but it is, to me, part of the emotions, you know. So whatever it is, and we enter, and some of us, you know, go through those, and it kind of has a spiral effect, because psychological time, I like to think of it more in like quantum time. It doesn't happen in a linear fashion, you know, in like linear time. It doesn't happen. So we can keep experiencing the same emotions over and over and over. If we're working with them, if we're giving expression to them, then as we move through linear time, they're not as intense when it comes back around. For instance, I started singing. I took up voice when New Orleans was destroyed because I had to find some way to express my grief and keep working, and I did not want to get, you know, buried in a grief process. So I started singing, and I started singing, you know, old hymnals and took it up seriously, took up voice. And anybody that's, you know, taken up singing seriously knows that it's a body experience. So it was great, Elaine. It was one of the best things I've ever done for myself. And I really hope people, if they don't hear anything else they say, is that we have to tap into our creative place and be able to give these deep emotions expressions. If we push them down, you know, suppress them, in favor of positive thinking, let's say, and we want to deny that it's there, they will come back around in some kind of way, it'll make you ill. You know what I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
I don't need to go on, you know, any further. Or we will attack loved ones. You know, there's all sorts of things.
But there are people out there that may be in our audience that might need to hear that, if not for the first time,
mm-hmm.
again, because
mm-hmm.
we don't know where our audience is in
That's
their life
true.
Right now. There could be somebody out there looking for a question, a timing question, or we'll hear you say something that somebody else told them 2 years ago, but now they're ready to hear it.
And then,
none of this is redundant. All of it is important that you're saying.
Yeah. And I think that if we're grieving, we have, you know, like I said, we've got to give it expression, but we also have to move forward. We can't get stuck. If we get stuck in it, then we can really spiral down, you know, and you can tell if you're stuck. I mean, everyone knows.
How do you know?
Well, you could fall into a major depressive episode. You know, you get lay down on the couch and not get up. Maybe you start drinking too much. Maybe you start doing too many drugs. Maybe you're, you know, abusing prescription medications. Maybe you start to become reclusive, like I did. That's what I did. I got stuck in it. I became extremely reclusive for years. I barely left the house. And then some things, you know, happened, and I began to move forward. And that's, it's usually my experience with people in grief is if they will reach out to someone that's able to hold it for them. I don't know how to say this, like create a space, if you will, a container, if you will, metaphorical space, so the person has a safe place to go. So we need a safe place to go so we can say whatever we need to say without fear of being judged. And when we're grieving, we can't always go to our relatives, you know, our close friends. You know, we can't always do that, you know. And so sometimes we need professional help, you know, to help us move forward in the grief process.
Okay. There are all kinds of grieving. We grieve for all kinds of things. I wanted to ask
mm-hmm.
you a while ago, you specialize in midlife crisis, but you
mm-hmm.
also specialize...
No, not midlife crisis, midlife transition.
Transition.
Not everybody enters midlife in a midlife crisis. That's...
Well, and I picked that up because of the midlife and beyond, from chaos to creativity,
mm-hmm.
my misconception. But what I was asking a while ago is, you're 20 years old, but you're going through a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
You're 50 years old and going through a crisis. How? What is, besides youth and lack of experience, do you often see similarities in how people handle them regardless of age, or is it a whole group of habits or assumptions that age groups go through? I don't think I've asked you that clearly.
Well, no, I think I have it, because I'm thinking of a young client that I have, a young actress I have that lost her father a few years back. I would say that it's almost, it doesn't matter. I mean, of course, when we're older, we're expected, you know, our peers, our family, they expect us to handle it differently than we would when we're younger. But the process is pretty much based on the work of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Are you familiar with her?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
My partner is a specialist in death and dying, of course.
Okay, of course. Well, then you know what I'm talking about. There are stages that people go through. Now, I do believe that the personality of the person can dictate how they deal with that. And also, if they have a masculine or feminine grieving style. And so women, and this doesn't have anything to do with gender, women can have masculine grieving styles, and that's where it looks like the person, you know, they don't want to talk about it, and they get busy and they go through their lives. Well, actually, what's going on is that it is being worked out, but it's being worked out maybe at the unconscious level, you know, or maybe in the dreams, in the dream world, or maybe just right at preconscious level, or maybe they're thinking about it, you know, and then when they're ready, they talk, okay? That's a very, very masculine grieving style. A feminine grieving style would be someone who really does need to talk. They need to talk about it. They need to express it. They need a witness. And not everybody needs a witness to their grief. Not everybody needs that. You know, a lot of, and I know I didn't really let too many people witness the deep grief I've gone through recently with Katrina. And we call it Katrina brain now, by the way. And so I get Katrina.
I still get how far you've gotten with your essays for the book.
Well, I'm they're coming along. The one that there's several of them, and some of them are on the website. You know, they're not in finished form. So they're coming along. I mean, I've got in process probably about 10 or 11 essays. Some of them I've been working on. Walking in the Light of Abraham I've been working on off and on for 5 years, and I'm just about finished with that one. And once I get that finished, I feel like the others will come very rapidly, because that really is kind of a personal essay about my own spiritual process, if you will, you know. So
I'll be excited to read that.
And it's
going to be
fun
to read.
I like humor. I like gentle humor. If we can stay there. I think we take ourselves too seriously sometimes, and I definitely think we think about ourselves too much, you know, in this culture. And so that brings me back to the imagination, you know, and creativity and humor. And I was thinking about this before, you know, our call today, and I thought, you know, well, what does one, you know, from my personal point of view, you know, what do we need to, you know, develop, if you will? And I was just trying to think of the things that I've been taught and that I've noticed other people, you know, do that really begins to make this process a little easier, you know, the grief process or whatever it is that you're doing when you're transitioning, and that is, you know, really cultivating humility. You know, a humble heart, you know, because everything has to be transmuted or transformed in the heart anyway, you know, and all the major religions say that, you know. The Christians say the kingdom of God, you know, resides in the heart. The Hindus, you know, say it's, you know, the supreme God Brahma lives in the heart. In Islam, the heart's referred to as the throne of God, you know. And so what we have to do is we have to figure out how to put our prejudices aside, or our ideas about what we think about this, and we come and we learn to center in the heart, you know, and center in our own, you know, psyche, in our own heart and mind, and develop what some people call, you know, thinking heart, and not stuff the emotions down, and not make judgments, value judgments, about whether or not it's right or wrong to feel, you know, any particular way. You know, your emotions are just sort of signposts toward what you really value anyway and what's going on with you. So they're very valuable.
Let's give the phone number again. USA 1-877-270-8714. The international number is 1-888-284-3264. We have been visiting tonight with Nancy Harding, a specialist, a licensed professional counselor with a certification in career and retirement counseling, although we haven't talked about retirement this evening so far. We've gotten into other subjects,
yeah,
which has been fun.
Yeah. That certification in retirement, that's really my day job. That's what supports me while I do all this other creative stuff and have my private practice, you know, my depth psychological practice. Does not completely support me. Like I said, you know, you're not going to get rich, you know, counseling or anything like that. And so I spend about 15 hours a week. I have an international presence in the business world. And there it is called retirement counseling. Actually, I do what are referred to as the psychology of retirement. People definitely, real serious, you know, executives, they definitely have a bit of an issue in transitioning, you know, out of their jobs, and they're transitioning by the thousands now, and so people lose jobs every day. I'm sure you're aware of that. That happens all the time, you know.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, and it's just the nature of the beast, if you will, and, you know, we are a capitalist culture. You know, we're a corporate culture. One of my favorite things that I made up, and it's in that essay, Scrapping for a Chicken Bone, is I consume, therefore I am. I think that's our collective mantra. You know, we consume, therefore we are, you know, whatever. You know, I mean, we even can go, you know, and buy just about anything we want in the spiritual marketplace also, you know, and so everything's for sale. You know, everything's for
sale. You know, yes, everything's for sale. Yeah. What you were saying in your essay, too, about your marketing, I love that. It's distinguished as retirement, which in my mind is more of a marketing term,
yeah,
than a life stage.
Mm-hmm.
Really got me to thinking.
Yeah, because it's almost a myth. It's a myth that most people retire behind a gated community, you know, or something. It really truly is a myth. I mean, some people do get to do that in this country, but the baby boomers, which we comprise almost a third of the U.S. population, and it's pretty much the same in Western Europe and Canada because of World War II. And so, we're just this vital force, you know, on the planet. But most of us, about 70% of us, are not financially prepared. So we're going to be working in some capacity till we're about 70 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of us are going to do that. And so it really is truly a myth that everybody gets to retire. But what research does indicate, and my professional observation has indicated, is that what a lot of us do is that we do what I do. We work part-time. In fact, most of my friends, I don't even know if I know anybody that works at our age full-time anymore. I'm trying to think off the top of my head if I know anyone. I mean, we're engaged in all sorts of things. And so I don't have as much money as I used to, but I also don't work 18 hours a day, you know. And
the big difference in my practice, in both of my practices, I see people that are 67, 68, 69, still working full-time jobs. In fact, I had a client 2 or 3 days ago. She works for the state. She retired from the state. Now she went back to the state as a special consultant. She's 72.
Mm-hmm.
You'd never know it, but they are,
mm-hmm,
paying for her wisdom and her experience. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And she made the
right
comment that she'll work until one or the other falls apart, her brain or her body. She loves
it.
Yeah,
and some people really want to do that. And so I'm not saying that I'm not engaged, you know, every day, you know, in a lot of activities, or that my clients aren't. But most of my clients, unless they're from the corporate world, you know, do not work full-time anymore. They're doing other things. you know, their ties.
Enjoying life, hopefully.
Enjoying life,
at least enjoying
yeah,
their
definitely.
People.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. And
well, as much as I hate to wrap this up, we're going to have to start wrapping it up. Let's.
Well,
thank
you for
you
having
reach...
me, and I really appreciate it. And I wanted to tell you, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, it's. I wish we had another hour. I would love for you to come back at some point in time in a couple of months and give us an update on what's happening with you. And, of course, the closer you get to getting your things published or more on the site, I hope people will go to your website and read some of your work. It's wonderful. The site is easy to move around in. It's has a wealth
of
information
friend.
There. Yeah, it's www.selfcompass.com, and you can reach Nance at nance@selfcompass.com. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us, and hopefully you will come back and spend another with us.
I would love to, Elaine, and thank you very much, and have a good evening.
You too. Thank you, world, for having been with us. This has been Going Global for Spirit with Elaine Ireland on, of course, bbsradio.com. Check out my website, elaineirelandpsychic.com. Let me know what you think. If you have some folks or some topics that you would like to have touched, please send me an email or call me. I would love to know it. Thank you again, Nance. Have a great
Thank
weekend.
You too.
Bye, world. Stay
Bye-bye.
Happy.
Bye-bye.